Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How do people construct their family stories? Michael Chabon explores this and a lot more in his latest novel, Moonglow.
I am offended by the apparent privileging of so-called reality, so-called truth, over fictional truth.
Who was the woman people called the First Lady of the World? Blanche Weisen Cook is here to talk about her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt.
She was really just this pioneering figure who said everywhere she went, tell me, what do you want? What do you need?
Also, what we and other people are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Michael Chabon joins us now. His latest novel is Moonglow, and it's reviewed this week on the cover of the Book Review. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Tell us the origin story for this latest novel.
At the time that it originated, I had absolutely no idea where it was coming from. It was a very mysterious experience, and I've only really ever had something like this happen once before with a book, and that was with Wonder Boys. Out of nowhere, this family story that I'd heard a few times growing up about a great uncle of mine who was fired from his job to make room on the payroll for Alger Hiss after Alger Hiss got out of prison and he was basically unemployable. I had not been thinking about Alger Hiss or that great uncle or anything. I have no idea where that whence that arose, but it did, and I just started to follow the thread of that little family story until I suddenly, soon after, realized I was working on this novel that was going to be in the form of a memoir. Well, after only about 3 days of work and sort of working my way into the story of the character who became the narrator's grandfather in this book and telling the story of how he got, how he responded when he found out he was losing his job to make room on the payroll for Alger Hiss. I mean, any answer I give you, like where did this book come from or what were your concerns or what went into it, to a certain degree it would be invention, because the truth is I really don't know.
But it started, it sounds like, with this character.
Started with this actual family story that I had heard. From that, it was a great uncle, mm-hmm. and I just quickly shifted into grandfather, and from the very beginning, I was writing a first-person narrator, so he was saying my grandfather, and, as soon as I turned it from an uncle, great uncle, to my grandfather, then it becomes a work of fiction, right? When my grandfather, my actual grandfather, was dying, my mother's father, he was dying at my mother's house in Oakland, California. She essentially brought him home to die and to her house to die. And she had him in a hospital bed that she'd rented. And I went to visit and sat with him a lot. And he was on heavy-duty painkillers, and he talked a lot during those hours that I was with him. And I heard a lot of stories that I had never heard before. I'd heard a lot of stories from him over the years. I wouldn't have thought there were more stories to hear. And yet all of these things I had never heard before seemed to, that these lids on these old containers seemed to get opened up. And he was just remembering things from his earliest childhood that I had never heard from him before. And so not only did I have that sense of, oh, wow, there's all these other things I've never heard, but it also, of course, left me wondering, like, what else is in there? And what's inside all of my grandparents that they didn't ever tell me, that they never communicated? That at that time, I was probably about 25 years old, and I think 25 in that time in the early to mid-20s is when you start to realize, often belatedly, when it's too late to do anything about it, that your grandparents were were young people too once.
Right.
You know, and that they had sex and they had conflicts of conscience and were tormented and struggled with their identities and all of the things that are happening to you when you're that age, and you suddenly, I think you can suddenly have this realization. So for me, it just made this strong impression. I think it's not like I said at that moment, I'm going to write a book about this someday. But when I did start writing this story that was drawing so heavily on a family story, that actually was about one of my grandfather's brothers. It was one of his brothers who was fired from his job. You know, then I think that time that I had spent with my actual grandfather appeared almost instantly as a possible framework for shaping this narrative, for giving some kind of shape to it.
It's interesting because when you started off talking, you said, instead of saying something like, you know, I'd heard about this uncle of mine, you said I'd heard a story about the uncle of, you know, this uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting choice of words because a lot of this is sort of about the stories we tell. And then the line, you know, about ourselves, about family is the narratives that we construct. And then
exactly
the reality and that it's not always the same thing.
Right. And you know, it's the stories we tell and the stories we don't tell and the things that are sort of decided on as a kind of consensus version of what happened. And sometimes those decisions are imposed by one parent or another, let's say, or both parents. And sometimes they're just sort of arrived at through a kind of collective mythification until sort of there's a standard version of what happened. But a lot of times there isn't, that process never quite congeals and people never really agree on what happened. And,
right.
And you know, anyone who has siblings knows how that goes. And you start saying, remember that time this and that and mom said that, and your sibling's like, that's not what happened. It was the other way. I was there. Well, I was there too. We were both there.
Right.
And we both have completely or significantly different memories of the order things happen in. That felt like very rich, ripe material for me. You know, in fact, as soon as I realized I was doing this, I got in touch with my cousin, second cousin, who is the granddaughter of the uncle, her grandfather, my great uncle, my grandfather's brother, and her mother, and said, hey, you know, I'm doing this, I'm working with this material about Uncle Jack, and, you know, what do you guys know about this, or what do you remember about that? And they didn't know it. So, and then that made me question it. Like, well, where did I, was it the other uncle? I can't have made that up. It was so both at the same time incredibly specific and totally irrelevant in a way. It's not like it doesn't put our family at the center of history or in any way or anything. It's just a weird little tangent.
It's also like kind of this fulfillment of this fantasy to find out the stories of your grandparents, because you mentioned, you know, earlier on that your own grandfather died when you were in your 20s, and that it's sort of at that age that one's, you know, grandparent, assuming that they live a long life, would tend to die. And yet the narrator in this story is clearly older than that. He has a
right.
daughter. So when you kind of do the math, unless the grandfather is living an extraordinarily long life, it's sort of impossible that would all kind of fit together in exactly that way, that he would be able to tell that story at that point in the narrator's life.
Whatever I needed to do, I did. In the end, all of my books are autobiographical, even the ones that seem least likely to be so, you know, like a book like Gentleman of the Road, which is set in the year 1000 in Central Asia. And, you know, it's about swordsmen for hire. You know, there are elements in that story that I drew from my own personal observation and personal experience and things that happened to me, I think, appear, you know, heavily transformed and transfigured in ways that only I might ever be able to point to or notice, but they're there. And even in this book, which is, it seems so autobiographical, it is overtly claiming to be autobiographical.
Right.
I think it's actually no less fictional than almost any other book I've written. And at the same time, it's no more fictional either. It's probably close to the same proportion of things that are true of me true for me, things that I've observed or had happened. It's just a novel, ultimately, like any of my other novels.
Although it does seem like you're playing more deliberately with the idea of the lines between the novel and the autobiographical novel and the memoir in this book.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, once I caught on to what I was up to, in a sense, and I thought, okay, I'm working in this form. I have this narrator, and he's presenting this as, quote-unquote, my grandfather. And this narrator is increasingly feeling more and more like someone close to me. In terms of the narrator's biography and details of the narrator's origin. And then I saw an opportunity to explore my own feelings and attitudes as a novelist, as a writer of fiction, and as a lover of fiction, and even more perhaps as a reader of fiction, a lifelong lover of novels, toward the whole phenomenon of the memoir, the literary memoir, and the rise of the literary memoir over the past, say, couple of decades. It's not like I'm setting out to knock the literary memoir, but I'm offended as a novelist and as a lover of novels. I'm offended by the apparent privileging of so-called reality,
right.
So-called truth.
True stories.
Over fictional truth. No, I think most memoirists are not only conscious of the fictionalizing aspect of what they're doing, but struggle with that and try to find ways to be straight with readers about that. But it's certainly not necessary, and a great literary memoir doesn't have to sort of acknowledge its truthiness in any way. And I'm uneasy about that, and I think just inherently I prefer a form that is not only using deception, mm-hmm. using trickery, telling and using invention and fundamentally telling lies, and is open and honest about that, which is the case of the novel, which is being consumed by a reader who's saying beforehand, look, lie to me, please. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be lied to. I'm ready to be lied to. Let's hear it. I want to hear a lie that's so good that I will believe it, and it will make me feel everything that hearing some kind of account of a factual occurrence can't make me possibly know or feel that I will have no access to otherwise. For me, that's a more desirable experience for me as a reader. And there was a certain amount of built-up resentment mm-hmm. in me as a novelist, and again, as like a lover of fiction toward the literary memoir that sort of I had a little bit of a afsaluchis, just a little bit of spitefulness, a little bit of malice driving me toward this memoir form, because I really kind of wanted to show, in a sense, just how easy it is to make up a memoir.
You use a number of different devices to play with that notion of, like, that idea between stories and the truth, and you have the counterfactual in here, as you've done in previous novels, where you kind of tweak reality. You have the character of the grandmother, who mm-hmm. is a bit of an unreliable narrator. She's mm-hmm. a storyteller. Tell us a little bit about her character.
I had an amazing experience writing that character, an experience I've never really had before in any of my books with any of my other characters, which was that initially, because she is by nature and by definition and by the way I had just conceived her from the beginning, enigmatic, mm-hmm. and there is a mystery about what happened to her during the war. There was something that for the longest time felt sort of inviolable about that to me as a writer, and I was sort of content to leave her as an enigma and let her be an enigma to her husband, to her grandson, to her daughter, to the people in her life. That worked okay in the sense that I was able to complete a couple of drafts of the book, but in response to the reads that I got from Ayelet, from my wife, and from my editor, and from a couple of other trusted readers, you know, one of the things they all said is they want, you know, we want more grandmother.
Hmm.
We want more of her. This idea that she's an enigma, you know, it may be true, but it's not working with her as a literary character in this book. Like, we need more from you about her. And so then I had to sort of try to solve a problem. I'm like, okay. And I mean, at the same time, they were kind of saying, like, but don't make her enigmatic. Like, mm-hmm. that's fine. So I had to try to find this way. And I kind of turned to this what became the last draft of the book, feeling like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to make her be both an enigma and at the same time that we feel her and feel like she's real and we know her, and yet without going into her point of view, which I didn't feel, you know, like I could do or wanted to do or should do. And then I just started writing, and this was last spring, last March, and I gave myself a month to do a new draft of this book. And what I found was, as soon as I opened up space in the book for her, she filled it. And I knew so much more about her than I had known that I knew about her. And all of the stuff I needed to know about her fit, and it fit in with the thematics of the novel as I had already established them. And I started noticing all of these things in other parts of the book, parts that either had to do with the grandmother already or didn't even have to do with the grandmother, that got deepened and enriched by her increased presence in the book and in her presence in the form that it was increasingly taking it. So it just seemed as though I had just been waiting. I had many things seem to be sort of lying in readiness in various parts of the book, waiting for me to sort of plug the character of the grandmother in more fully. And when I did, all of these other understandings of other characters became clearer to me. And so I found that I suddenly understood the figure of the narrator's mother much better than I had before, because now I understood her mother so much better. Right. And that's not unusual for me. It's often at the very end, the very last things that I write in a book turn out to be the things that give me, after years of work, the insight into the novel that I've sort of been missing all along.
Since you're talking about what you've added to the book at the end of the process, mm-hmm. let's talk about something that you wrote at the very beginning, but took out, and we're publishing that. I don't know if you think of it as an excerpt or sort
right.
of...
No, the semi-erection, no, it's not an excerpt because it's not in the book.
Right, a bonus chapter.
It's like an outtake, I suppose.
Right, cutting room floor, mm-hmm. the Sandmeyer reaction, which
right.
we are publishing online. Talk a little bit about that and how you realize that didn't belong in the final novel.
I mean, I always leave things out. I always waste time. I always spend weeks or months or years working on parts of a book that end up having to be left behind. You know, I wrote an entire 600-plus first draft of the Yiddish Policeman's Union that I put aside and started over again. This was different because on that day I was talking about earlier, where I sort of found after just a few days' work on the book that I suddenly knew what all the five or six main plot strands in the story were going to be. And one of those strands was something that I just called the spy hunt. And rather than little plot details, as with some of my other strands, it was more of an emotion. I had an emotional sense, like, this is going to be his test under fire, the grandfather's, the way that the future course of his life is set, and mm-hmm. the way that everything he's experienced up to now is sort of brought to bear. And you see that he's a sort of quixotic, romantic, but also kind of violent and bloodthirsty in some way, and also... dogged and rational and scientific in his approach, and I felt like there was going to be something with a spy. I knew that he was going to go to work for the OSS and be in Army intelligence. I had another great uncle who worked in Army intelligence during the war, so I was already planning to include some material around that. And I kept putting off that spy hunt, and I wasn't ready for it. But by the same token, knowing what that was going to be about thematically, or emotionally for the grandfather, guided me completely in everything else I wrote up to that point. And then when I wrote it, finally did get around to it, I had this incredibly intense writing experience. I was at the McDowell Holiday, and it was kind of like a 2 weeks of nothing but this story of this spy hunt in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia, just in the middle of World War II. I mean, when I was done, it was rough after those 2 weeks, but I thought, well, that was an amazing experience, and this is going to be a linchpin of this book like I always thought it would be.
And when did you realize that it didn't even belong in the book?
Not till the end, like in this same period, even after I had completed that last draft, the sort of grandmother draft, if you will, and I was now just getting the manuscript ready for to send it into my editor, to submit it to the publisher, and as I was just reading with an eye to cutting, I got to that part of the book in the manuscript, the spy hunt part. immediately I just got this feeling in my stomach of, I don't know what, there's something wrong here. I decided, like, I just had this feeling it didn't belong. I didn't need it anymore. The book didn't need it anymore. And I went back and started rereading the book, seeing, like, okay, if anything happens up till that point, the story seemed to be pointing to that story. And the answer turned out to be no. And then I said, okay, that's not good. And then I kept going, and I'm looking and say, okay, does anything that happens after this point in the story refer back to this episode? Does it seem to have, you know, if it weren't here, would anything be different? And the answer was no. And then when I saw that, I realized, wow, this, I don't need this anymore.
You chose to publish this separately, the Sandmeyer reaction.
Right.
Why did you want to get it out there?
In a way, the thing that made it, that doomed it, that put it on the chopping block, was the very thing that made me feel like it might be able to be published on its own, which is that it stood alone, you know, it didn't depend on previous context in any way, and it didn't, when it ends, it ends, and nothing sort of comes out of it either. So, I mean, the very things that made it not belong in as a piece of a whole made it seem like a middle. Maybe it's a whole in its own right.
So listeners can read that extra bonus chapter by going on our website at nytimes.com/books and hopefully read the new novel as well. The book again is called Moonglow by Michael Chabon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Eleanor Roosevelt spent much of her life in the public eye, but a new biography of her, the third in three volumes, looks at her life during a period when she was arguably one of the country's most visible people, between 1939, on the eve of World War II, to her death in 1962. Her biographer, Blanche Wiesen Cook, is here to talk to me now about her new book, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. Blanche, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So this is bringing a trilogy of a biography to a close. How do you feel now having finished this? This has taken, the first volume came out in 1992?
Yes. I've been working on it since 1982.
Wow.
It actually feels wonderful to be done, but as Joe Lash said when he first encouraged me to write about Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite, and there are all these stories still to come, and I welcome the future. Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite, but how important she is for this moment when we have to reconsider her vision, her great vision for politics and humanity, which is, she always said, governments exist for only one purpose, to make life better for all people. And that was her commitment, and that was her work. So we have Eleanor Roosevelt spending her entire life from the 1920s on saying we need to build movements for change. We need to build movements by going door to door, block by block, community by community to make our wants and our needs known. She was really just this pioneering figure who said everywhere she went, tell me, what do you want? What do you need? And everybody, she always said, needed to have education. And long before Bernie, Eleanor Roosevelt said, we need to have free public college education for all. She said that in 1943. But we need more than that. We need training, jobs, help, security, dignity for all people.
Did you go into this vast project as an admirer of hers? And was that your motivation in telling her story?
You know, I always say my life is an accident because I started out in life as a gymnast and had an accident and I couldn't go to the Olympics and major in phys ed. What happened was I was working on Eisenhower, and Kate Stimson sent me books to review in Abilene, Kansas. And one of the books was a very mean book about Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok by Doris Faber, who was the first to look at these letters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wrote this dreadful book saying these letters couldn't possibly mean what they seemed to mean. And I wrote a fairly nasty review. And I called Joe Lash up, her biographer, and he was my friend who had blurbed my Crystal Eastman book. This is a book that should stay in print forever. And you get to be friends with people who blurb your book that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him up and I said, what's up with you not even mentioning Hick in any of your work? And he said, I hated her. Let's have dinner. So we had dinner. And why he hated her was that she was a bit of an anti-Semite and a bigot.
Lorena Hickok.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so he didn't write about her, and he said, why don't you do it? And I was a military historian. I had just finished Eisenhower, and I said, don't be ridiculous. I do hard history. And he said, goddess, forgive me. And he said, you know, you're wrong. And he took me up to Hyde Park, where the papers are amazing. And it was clear that he was the good son. Anything Eleanor Roosevelt dealt with, he dealt with. Anything she didn't want to deal with, he didn't deal with. She said, I don't care about power. So he wrote, she didn't care about power. And then I knew I had a story, and mm-hmm. I thought I could finish it by her centennial in 1984. And that was the origins of this book. It just grew bigger and bigger as more and more interviews and material surfaced. When I say there's so much more to do, Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite. For about 6 years, I worked at the State, I was on the State Department Historical Advisory Office Committee, and before each meeting, I would get mountains of material from my boss, Bill Slaney, saying, this is what we're going to talk about, this is what I want you to think about. And so one day I said, look at all the stuff you send me.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Eleanor Roosevelt's State Department file when she worked at the UN? He said, well, let's go look for it. And we found 198 boxes, which, because we had then top secret security clearance, we just declassified right away. And so those boxes, you know, really are filled with stunning material. You know, I mean, it's not her biography, and so I didn't use all of it or much of it. And there was supposed to be a Foreign Relations of the U.S. series based on those materials, but that hasn't happened.
If you had to describe the experience of writing each of these, you know, three volumes briefly, and kind of what made each of them different from the others or special, how would you describe the first one versus the second and the third?
Well, the first one is really understanding how Eleanor Roosevelt became Eleanor Roosevelt, the most beloved person in the world. At some point, I quote Claire Booth Luce, who thought Eleanor Roosevelt should run for political office, even for vice president or president. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, I would rather be chloroformed than run for office. And here's the quote that I was looking for. Claire Booth Luce noted that E.R. was among the world's best loved women for many reasons, but above all, no woman has ever so comforted the distressed or distressed the comfortable. And I think that no woman has ever so comforted the distressed is really important. The question always was, how did she get that way? She went around the country and around the world trying to make things better for people in need, in trouble. And the first volume is really about her childhood and school years and early marriage. And that is the answer to the question. Her childhood was a childhood of misery and loss. Her father, who she loved, was an alcoholic who died at the age of 34. And all of us of a certain age who drink too much wonder, how much do you have to drink to die at the age of 34? And what was her childhood like? Her mother turned her face essentially to the wall when Eleanor was 8. Her father died when she was 10. And she was, you know, orphaned into the world. And the big boost to her life were her years at the Allenswood School in England, where her, you know, great mentor, Marie Souvestre, the splendid educator, a woman who recognized Eleanor's brilliance and recognized the direction of her heart and her great, her many gifts, and really encouraged her, but encouraged her above all and all of her students to think for herself and be independent and bold.
It would seem that in a three-volume biography like this, the middle one might be the hardest because, you know, you're not dealing with sort of the origins or with the end story and the culmination, but with that middle period.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt said that she lived her life as an adventurer. And one of the things that happens when you're writing about an adventurer whose life is filled with new excitement every day is that you just keep going. I mean, she drove the story. She never stopped growing and changing. And one of the things that's sort of interesting is, you know, she was a serial romantic. There are very, very close people in her life who are her mentors and allies, people like Esther Lape, L-A-P-E. I tell my graduate students there is no biography of Esther Lape, who is this brilliant woman who campaigns all of her life for what we now call single-payer health care, which was supposed to be in the 1935 Social Security Act. The AMA lobbied it to death. When Eisenhower, who was a great liberal, as I like to say, as people need to hear these days, the Republican Party was once run by great people like Dwight David Eisenhower. He asked Eleanor Roosevelt, he fired her and didn't want any part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but he asked her to come back and help him with Esther Lape get his National Health Care 1957-58 law passed, which he thought was going to be, just as it was in the military, everybody covered, no problem. And he hired Ovita Culp Hobby to be, you know, he appointed Ovita Culp Hobby to be head of HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, with the proviso, because she was a Texas woman, publisher, head of the Women's Army Corps, with the proviso that this would cover everybody, black and white, with equality. And I met Bill Hobby, who told me his mother said, of course, and she was a life member of the NAACP. So Eleanor Roosevelt and Esther Leib supported this. They really campaigned for it. And then Eisenhower gave the pen for that health reinsurance bill to Esther Leib, and she waved it in front of the reporters, and she said, "Now this represents just a puny little bone in the vertebrae of what I had in mind." So here we are in the 21st century. We're the only industrial country without a single-payer health care. And this is really astonishing as we go forward. You know, all of these great stories, I mean, they're long-ranging, you know, and Eleanor Roosevelt understands social change is a process, not an event.
In telling the story, this last volume of Eleanor Roosevelt's life, does it kind of divide naturally into the 1939 to FDR's death in 1945 and then the post-FDR years?
What happens is Eleanor Roosevelt tells the press after FDR dies, the story is over. And she is surprised when Harry Truman... immediately, she and Harry Truman become allies. She gives him instructions. He has no idea about what FDR has arranged. He was always kept in the shadows, and Eleanor Roosevelt really decides to help him. And then he asks her to go and be the first UN representative, post-war UN representative, in London, and she at first says no. And it's her friends and her children who say, "You have to do this." And then she agrees to go. And of course, she discovers, because she lives her life as an adventurer, that she loves it. She takes her column with her, her radio show. She's the star. Eleanor Roosevelt's understanding, which was very clear as Vandenberg and the Dulles brothers were really rude to her. John Foster Dulles disliked her intensely until her diplomacy was so stellar, he went to her and apologized and said, "I know we've been sort of nasty to you, but now we really admire you." And Eleanor Roosevelt told her friends, "Men hate women with power." But she always says, "We have to be courageous. Courage is as contagious as fear. We just have to pick up and go on."
Would you say that courage was the quality that really distinguished Eleanor Roosevelt, that made her the extraordinary person that she was? And were there other qualities?
Well, I think both courage and empathy. Eleanor Roosevelt really cared about people, all people. And she was very impressed with Wendell Willkie's epiphany when he went around the world in 1942 and he came back and he wrote One World. Everything that happens anywhere affects all of us, everywhere, affects everyone, everywhere. And that became sort of Eleanor Roosevelt's mantra. And so I dedicated the book to all those activists and agitators who resist tyranny, challenge authority, fight for peace, freedom, and human rights as we continue our journey for one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls.
Well, you've just made a very clear argument for the relevance of this book today. Blanche Wiesencook, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Blanche Wiesencook is the author again of Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962, third in her trilogy of a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. My colleagues Greg Coles and John Williams join us now to talk about what we and other people are reading. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, let's talk about the other people first. Greg, what's new on the bestseller list?
Well, there's a new Lee Child novel right at the top of the hardcover bestseller list. That book is Night School, which Charlie Finch reviewed for us and discussed on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. Now that it's officially been published, boom, right to the top of the list. Also, Stephanie Meyer back on the bestseller list with her second novel for adults. Stephanie Meyer, of course, wrote the Twilight series.
One of your favorites.
You know, it's really all about Robert Pattinson for me. No, so she now adapts that Twilight model, that kind of love triangle set up, to a spy thriller called The Chemist. That's new at number 5. And actually, coincidentally, Charlie Finch reviewed that book for USA Today. He liked it. He gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars.
Charlie Finch, of course, is our reviewer of thrillers in the most recent roundup that we did.
There's a couple of other books in hardcover fiction. There's also a couple on the hardcover nonfiction list this week. Notably, Arlie Russell Hochschild hits the list. She's a Berkeley sociologist. Her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, which is new at number 14, actually came out back in like September, but it didn't hit the list back then. So she's professor emeritus at Berkeley, a sociologist, and she spent the last several years studying the white working class in Louisiana, kind of Tea Party types, mm-hmm. Going down there and getting to know them, starting even before Obama won re-election. She wrote this book, Strangers in Their Own Land, talking about how those people were feeling. And of course, now after Donald Trump's election, the book has gotten a lot of renewed attention. She's been interviewed in various places. The New York Times and other places have pointed to this book as a book that can help people understand the results of the election. And so a couple of months after it was published, here it is making its debut on the hardcover nonfiction list.
Another book that kind of fits that category, but of course has been on the list for a while, is Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, which is holding strong at number 3.
That's right. That's after, I think, like 16 weeks. So that's 4 months on the list for him. And that book is partly sociology and partly memoir, because Vance himself grew up in Appalachia in the white working class.
All right, John, what about you? What are you reading?
Well, I'm still reading a book that probably will appear on the list shortly, which is Zadie Smith's new novel, Swing Time. It's about two girls who grew up together in London, both mixed race. The narrator's mother is black and her father is white, and then her best friend, her mother is white and her father is black. They both love dance, and the narrator goes on to work for be kind of a personal assistant to a really big global music star who I think is pretty clearly modeled, at least, you know, in terms of her provocations and things, on Madonna. And it's funny because I'm about halfway through now. And as you get older, you can, when you read about a book, you have a better and better sense of whether or not you're going to like it before you even start it, which is kind of a downer. My reaction is kind of similar to what I thought it would be, which is that the sections about the girls in London and their families are just terrific. And the parts about this rock star whose name is Amy, A-I-M-E-E, are just a little bit...
I can tell you don't even like the spelling.
Yeah, I don't, actually. I don't like the name. It doesn't ring true. It's like in Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, there was a bit about a guy who used to be a rock star, and I just felt everything about that kind of felt a little off and fake,
yeah.
Including the band name. And there's something similar here. I mean, it's still... She's a terrific writer, but I do find the music sections a little more staged and heavy-handed, and I'm always eager to get
staged,
back to the to get back to the girls and their childhood. But I like Smith a lot, and I read everything she does.
What's your favorite, Zadie?
My two favorites are probably White Teeth and N.W. I'm actually not a big fan of On Beauty, which a lot of people liked. I just felt like she was trying to do something traditional, but I think it went so far in that direction that it almost became a little boring to me.
I feel like the world divides into like the pro-NW and the anti-NW Zadie Smith.
I am a big NW fan myself, and I also read Swing Time, and I'm right there with you, John. The Madonna stuff, the Amy stuff felt maybe strained to me, or just too familiar in kind of the study of celebrity. But the stuff about the girls growing up in the housing projects in London, it feels very much like N.W., like she's revisiting this world that she also did in White Teeth, of course. You're getting the friendship and the kind of the social structure of life in the projects.
And it feels a little, I'm sure it is a little memoiristic.
Oh, autobiographical,
you know,
sure.
And she's written around the book, she's talked to The Times and she wrote in The Guardian about her own growing up and her love of dance and what it meant to her. So that's a big part of their childhood. And
Zadie can sing and Zadie can dance and Zadie can write. she can wear a great dress. What can she not do?
Zadie is very unfair.
Yeah,
she's definitely
unfair
in that category. But, you know, we'll read her anyway.
All right, Greg, what are you reading?
Coincidentally, since you just talked to him earlier in this podcast, I've been reading Michael Chabon's new book, Moonglow, which, as you know, is also has this memoiristic feel. It's funny because a few weeks ago I talked on the podcast about this Belgian novel, War and Turpentine, by Stefan Hertmans. And that book is also has this kind of memoiristic feel and is about the author slash narrator's grandfather, as is Michael Chabon's Moonglow. So on the surface, the books would seem to have a lot in common. In the nitty-gritty, when you're actually reading them, they feel very, very different. And largely that has to do with tone, I think. Michael Chabon is very much a comic writer. He's a rollicking storyteller. He just kind of hooks you in with these shaggy dog stories that keep you turning the pages. Stefan Hertmans is much more pondering, not to say ponderous. I mean,
I've heard him compared to Sebald, which is definitely not rollicking.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of Sebald in that book, including right down to, you know, he includes photos that he to illuminate the things that he's talking about. Very different feeling books, but tackling a very similar project, which is to view probably a fictional version, but based in some reality of the author's grandfather. So that's what I've been reading.
Pamela, how about you? What are you reading this week?
Well, I am going to give a familiar answer. I am back to Hamilton, which will be a relief to those who really did not appreciate. You laugh. People did not appreciate my reading from The Vegetarian, which I understand. Perhaps it's better taken in context. And I realize not all readers enjoy my dark tastes. And I'm not going to provide anything lighthearted this week either, because the page that I happen to be on, 608 for those tracking my glacial progress.
I see the end, though. I see the end in sight.
The end is in sight, yes. I used to have it memorized. I think it's 732. it is indeed 732. Well, 731, I'm well aware. And I don't want to suggest that this is not a great book and that it isn't actually, the narrative really does move. It's just me who's not moving with it. But the part that I'm up to has some interesting contemporary resonances, because it is about an election and the ugliness of elections. And this one in particular is a local election in New York for the New York legislature. And the reason why it becomes important in this narrative is because the legislature in New York at that time helped determine the Electoral College, which then might determine the presidential election.
You don't say.
Yes. And so because of that, this is now under President Adams, because of that potential to swing the New York elections, the Atlantic states were quite important at that time, because the South was really aligning, lining up as a Republican bloc versus the New England Federalists. So New York was pivotal, and Hamilton, not surprisingly, recognized that they might be able to swing the election by swinging the state legislature elections. And Aaron Burr also had the same realization. And so both of them got quite involved, even though neither was running personally in this election. And I'll just read a little bit about that. That April, New Yorkers out for a stroll could have stumbled upon either Alexander Hamilton or Aaron Burr addressing crowds on street corners, sometimes alternating on the same platform. They treated each other with impeccable courtesy. Neither seemed to have any hesitation about soliciting voters individually or in small groups. One Republican paper could scarcely believe Hamilton's strenuous campaigning as he rallied the faithful like a general marshaling men for battle. Quote, Hamilton harangues the astonished group. Every day he is seen in the street, hurrying this way and darting that. Here he buttons a heavy-hearted Federalist and preaches up courage. There he meets a group and he simpers in unanimity. He talks of perseverance and God bless the mark of virtue. The Federalist papers profess similar shock at seeing the patrician Burr working the Manhattan sidewalks, one paper asking how a would-be vice president could, quote, stoop so low as to visit every corner in search of voters, unquote. So if you think things are dirty now.
Dirty and shocking.
That's right. You know, it's funny because every time there's something horrible and scandalous in American politics, people say, you know, this is the worst it's ever gotten. And then the historians say, actually, no, it's not the worst things have ever gotten. It used to be quite ugly, you know, during X, Y, and Z campaign. But I have to say, I don't know if history in this particular instance proves that counter-argument quite right.
And on a happier note, I have a good friend who tonight is taking another good friend of ours who happens to be 8 years old to see Hamilton, and she could not be more excited. So there's a ray of sunshine in
yes.
week.
For those who can afford to see Hamilton, all the sunshine in the world. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.